This is kind of a talk about death, but really, as I said before, it's a talk about life, actually. And but I'm going to talk a little bit about these Buddhist practices called the cemetery contemplations. Is anybody familiar with these practices? A few people, right? I'm going to talk a little bit about Death Cafe. And I'm going to give you 10 tips. And I guarantee that at least one of these tips will reduce your fear of death. I guarantee that, okay? You can have your money back otherwise, okay? When you die. Right. Okay, so so let's begin. So I'm going to begin, actually, and what I want to do is I want us to imagine something. So if you like, you can close your eyes. I'm just going to sort of walk you through something briefly. Now, imagine we're in this room with Buddhist friends on a Tuesday night in West London. But imagine, as we sit here, the room around us starts to change. It's like a time machine. We start to go back through time. And we start to go through space. And the actual room is different. We're sitting on bare earth. It's in some sort of shack or a barn. There's a shrine. There's a teacher. There's candlelight. Suddenly, the teacher rings a bell and looks at us. And we get up, and we walk through the people, out the door, leave them behind, we're on our own. And we walk out onto what's like a hamlet or a village with a dirt track, not a street, it's just a little place. And we walk down this street, this dirt track, the various people out there, and they bow to us as we walk past. We walk along the track, and the buildings stop, we're now on a track, which is winding its way across fields. The sun's setting, it's the end of the day. And the track winds its way across fields, and it winds its way through bushes. We start to climb. We come into trees, we walk through trees. And the sun's going down, it's getting darker. And we notice something. We notice that we're starting to feel quite apprehensive. But we carry on walking, we walk through these trees, up the hill. And when we get to the top, we come out in a clearing. And by this time, actually, we're more than apprehensive. We're really quite anxious. And something else we notice, there's an awful smell. When we open our eyes, what we see is a scene of horror. There are piles of logs, look like they're preparing for a cremation, but there are also bodies lying around. Bodies in different states of decomposition. Young bodies, children, old people, adults. There are skeletons, there are bones. It's pretty awful, strong stuff. But we carry on. We walk into the middle and we sit ourselves down with a mat, with a blanket, with a cushion, next to a dead body. And we sit on cushion, and we manage our fear, we manage our nausea, and we breathe in, and we breathe out, and we breathe in, and we breathe out. Okay, well, you can open your eyes. Don't worry, we're not in a place like this. We're in West London, we're in a Buddhist centre, I'm in this very nice room, there are no corpses. Everything's going to be okay, right? So, what I described then was a charnel ground, a cremation ground. Now, they were common in India at the time of the Buddha, and for a long time afterwards. In fact, there were still places like that in India and in other places in Asia. and the Buddha recommended these places to his followers as one of the places that he suggested that they go and meditate. He also suggested places like forests, which sounds quite nice until you think, well, it's India, actually. In the middle of a forest, there's going to be tigers, beasts and stuff. The forest would be pretty terrifying, too. Or cave. I mean, cave doesn't sound too bad, right, does it? But, you know, a cave inside a mountain, no lights, strange noises, things coming in through the entrance when you're in the... I mean, you know, it's spooky stuff, right? I mean, he did also say you could go meditate in a glade. Sounds more my sort of thing, you know, or you could meditate under a... a tree, you know. But he recommended this. So you go to these places. It's in the Satipatthana Sutra, the Sutra on mindfulness, you know. So we did the mindfulness of breathing earlier. And he was saying to his followers, well, look, go to a cremation ground, a place where there's corpses, and sit next to the corpses and look at them and meditate. Well, why? I mean, it sounds awful. Well, in fact, there are 9 cemetery contemplations in Buddhism, and I'm not going to mention them because they are pretty grim, actually. They're pretty grim things, you know. You're contemplating a body as it's dissolving and going back to the earth, you know. Now, later on, this is early Buddhism, later on in the Mahayana and the Tibetans that came later, they also did this practice, but they sort of transformed it into a visualization. And they elaborated it. So maybe you wouldn't actually go to the cremation ground yourself, but you'd sit in a shrine room and you would imagine it. And then they started to populate it with, you know, Tibetan figures, dakinis as they say, you know, maybe these sort of demon figures and stuff. And they all started to imagine this thing, and it was regarded as a practice, you know, the same sort of thing, but maybe carried on in your mind. Now, I can read some of that stuff, because what that was about. This is Atisha's Contemplations on Death. It's not so horrific as the cemetery contemplations, but part of the aim was to reflect that death is inevitable. Our lifespan is decreasing continuously. Death will come whether or not we are prepared for it. Human life expectancy is uncertain. There are many causes of death. The human body is fragile and vulnerable. At the time of death, our material resources, our stuff, is of no use to us. Our loved ones cannot save us. Our own body cannot help at the time of death. Or, as I prefer to say, quoting one of my favourite philosophers, Woody Allen, life is full of loneliness and misery and suffering and unhappiness, and it's all over much too quickly. So, it's pretty strong stuff, isn't it? So, you reflect on that. Why? I mean, what's the point? You know, what is the point of doing all that? Why did the Buddha recommend it? Why did the Tibetans recommend it? Well, you know, the point of it was to loosen one's attachment to this life. But also, really, this is the sort of kernel of it for me anyway, was to face the fact that we too are going to die. There's no escaping it. We too are like these bodies that are rotting. They were once like us. And the Buddha is saying, face the fact, you are going to die. You know, put it right in your face. So he's first of all saying that. And second thing he's saying, I think, you know, amongst other things, but second thing which really strikes me is, face your fear of it. Face the fact that you're terrified of it. Accept it, right? Sit in this cemetery and feel the fear. Well, why? I mean, okay, that's why he said that, those two things, but why? What's the point? What is the point of doing that? I mean, we're going to die anyway, so why not just sort of get on with stuff and, you know, it happens when it happens? Well, I think the reason he said that and the reason that this is a practice is that if you do that, if you face your own death, if you accept, or to the extent you're able to accept the fact of your own death, and to the extent you're able to face your fear of your own death, guess what? Life becomes sweeter. Life becomes more precious. Life becomes more meaningful. That's the point. The point isn't to terrify people or to induce some disgust at, like, you know, the human body. You know, it's the fact that it rots and all these things happen to it. The point is to make us aware that life is precious. Life is sweet. So, but what use is it to us? I mean, you know, we're in London in 2016. You know, there isn't a charnel ground that I'm aware of in London. You know, it's, what can we do about it? Even if there was, could we face it? Would it be appropriate for us? No. I don't think we've got the stomach, as it were, for it, for that sort of stuff. And it's important to remember that the Buddha, you know, he was recommending these practices to his followers who were pretty far along the path already. They'd built up, you know, a huge amount of psychic reserves, you could say, huge amount of positivity, emotional positivity. He wasn't recommending it for fragile, vulnerable people, as far as I'm aware, anyway. But, you know, still we're faced with this, well, what use can we make of these teachings? Is there a way, are there ways where that we can apply this kind of thinking, this kind of practice in London in 2016? Well, you're going to be relieved to hear that the answer to that question is yes. And this is going to sound a little bit comical in a funny way after all that horror, but the Death Cafe is one way of doing that. Why? Well, what is Death Cafe for a start? You know, we have one here every month. But the Death Cafe was an idea which was begun by a guy who lives in London, John Underwood, about 7 or 8 years ago. And he'd read the work of Bernard Cretier, I think is his name, who's a Swiss, I think an anthropologist, something like that anyway, who had done a lot of work. He'd written about the fact that there isn't really any opportunity or many opportunities in Western culture, Western societies, Switzerland, to talk about death, to face the fact of your own death. And he'd been conducting some social experiments, and John Underwood had read about this and got inspired by it and decided that he would start something called the Death Cafe. And the point of the Death Cafe was just to be a social situation where people could come together and talk about death and dying. Now, he held the first one, apparently, in his own house, in his front room, with just him and his mum. That sounds quite terrifying to me, personally. anyway, since then, which was 7 or 8 years ago, if you now look up Death Cafe, you will see it is all over the world. It's on all 5, 6 continents, right? Where was it? 6 continents? 6 continents. 6 continents, yeah. Particularly popular in America, where, you know, there will be a Death Cafe going on somewhere, probably in the UK too, right now. You know, it's a popular thing. It's what John calls a social franchise, which means that you don't have to be trained. I'm not trained. You need to follow the rules of the Death Cafe, which are pretty simple. You've got to have tea and cakes. Cafe, after all. And the sugar for sure helps. Colin, is that right? You know, what's said in the room stays in the room. And, you know, one person speaks at once. It's sort of basic stuff, you know, it's not complicated. And that's it, really. So people come together talking about death. So we started this thing off. It's become really a popular thing. And that shows, I think, that there is a need for it, an appetite for it, right? Okay. Now, we live in a culture which is, you probably could say, it's death-denying. We were talking earlier, actually, upstairs, about there's some really positive things happening, isn't there? There's more films about death and dying, and it feels like there's something coming through at the moment, the last few years, which is amazing. But generally speaking, we live in a culture where that isn't encouraged. In fact, you could say it's suppressed. I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I don't believe the world is run by a small elite of lizards or Freemasons or whatever it is who are trying to stop us thinking about death for their own purposes. No, it's an unconscious conspiracy, if you like, to stop this thing. Why? Because we live in a secular society, generally speaking, and science and materialism have got nothing to say about death and the afterlife, as it were. It's a big white space on the map. And in the absence of having anything to say about it in the way that the old religions could, I think in some way they've chosen to just kind of like ignore it, really. Death, after all, in the medical world is seen as a failure. So, Death Cafe is an opportunity for people to come together and to talk about death. I think it's time for another Woody Allen quote here. He says, Woody Allen said, "I'm not afraid of death. I just don't want to be there when it happens." One of the things that comes up at Death Cafe, really what we talk about, I'd say, a lot of the time, is our fears. Our fears of death. Now, let's just, you know, lob some at me. You know, people here, tell me, what sort of things do you fear about death? Anybody got any suggestions?
Darkness.
The darkness. Any more?
Pain.
Or dying?
Pain.
Sometimes the feelings, going hungry, passing away, being in angry state.
Being in an angry state, yeah. Regrets. How you might feel, yeah. Yeah.
Regrets.
Regrets, big one. Big one.
Leaving family behind.
Yeah. Big one. Any more?
Not having to live the life, just like you said, regret, maybe not having to live the life that you wanted to or
right.
wish to.
Whatever. Yeah. Yeah, it's a big one, isn't it? It's a big one.
And it's not having fulfilled the mission.
Mm. Well, that's a big one, isn't it? Fear of regret, you know, fear of getting to the end of one's life and actually feeling like we've wasted it in some way or we've missed it, right? But I mean, you know, I've got one of my fears. I'm fear of you know losing it, losing control, you know, dementia, Alzheimer's, losing my identity. Losing your family. I mean, also we're afraid of other people dying, aren't we? Our partners, our children, our parents, our friends. You know, we've got all these fears around death, haven't we? And so, what actually happens? You know, they're the sort of things that come up at the death cafe. And of course, I don't know whether this is what you meant, the darkness, but you know, there is this big thing is what happens after death, or maybe nothing happens after death. Is that are we afraid of that? Are we afraid that nothing's going to happen? Or are we afraid that something awful... I mean, I don't... You know, we can fear that too. I grew up as a devout Catholic. My mother was a nun before she got married. Imagine how devout that is. She'd stopped being a nun when she got married, by the way. But she did meet my father in a Catholic bookshop. So I had a very, very Catholic upbringing. You know, so I was surrounded by you know... the iconography of this stuff, the afterlife, heaven and hell. It was strong stuff, actually. And, you know, I miss it in a funny way. I mean, I don't believe in the afterlife myself now, but I sort of do miss it, and I'm slightly envious of people who do believe in the afterlife. You know, I sort of wish there was an afterlife. You know, because it does seem a terrible shame, actually, that all this stuff, my opinions, my fascinating life, my memories, my preferences, my likes and dislikes, that they're all going to be gone, you know, and I'm not going to meet my friends again afterwards, you know. It's I'm sorry about that, but unfortunately, I'm afraid to say it, there isn't an afterlife. I don't know if anybody was in any doubts, but there you go. I'll just put you right. So, but you know, that's a big fear, isn't it? Is there something going to happen or not afterwards? Now, Buddhism is quite interesting in this respect. Because there is a Buddhist mythology of a kind of afterlife, rebirth, reincarnation, right? But, you know, it's not much comfort, is it, really, as these things go? I mean, the traditional view of the afterlife, there's a heaven, there's a hell, so if you behave badly, you're going to go down. You know, I remember this when I was a kid. Now, even then it seemed unfair. You could make a couple of mistakes and then you're sort of damned forever. It seemed a bit imbalanced. But then, you know, if you behave well, whatever that meant, then you could be in paradise forever, which, I've got to be honest, sounded really dull when I was a kid. Heaven sounded dull. But with Buddhism, there is this sort of mythology of rebirth that, as a consequence of our karma, of the consequences of our life, that's, you know, our energy, our motivations, that another life, another consciousness will arise, which in some way is dependent, you know, on the life that we've led. Well, it sounds sensible to me. I mean, it sounds believable. In fact, our teacher, Sanyar Akshtra, you know, he said about it, I think fairly recently, actually, he said he was reasonably persuaded by the truth of rebirth. I mean, it wasn't a ringing endorsement. And he's got some personal form in this matter himself. And, of course, he knew various Tibetan lamas who had apparently been reborn. But, so, you know, we could accept that it's a reasonable myth, I think. But... of course, it doesn't really give us much comfort if what we want to do is live after this life. Why? Because our identity does not survive the transition. You know, apart from maybe a few Tibetan lamas, generally speaking, we don't remember our past lives. We need to take a big imaginative leap to help this myth really condition the way we behave. We have to think, well, there may be a being whose life is a consequence of mine, and therefore maybe I should act in a certain way to help that being, to help the world. It takes a big imaginative leap. But what it really does, as most things do in Buddhism, it pushes us back into this life, into the present. You know, we cannot escape, really, into visions or myths or fantasies of the afterlife. Now, of course, there's this whole Tibetan thing, the Tibetan Book of the Dead. I'm not sort of going into that, but I'm sure everybody's heard about it. And it's, you know, there is an opportunity in Buddhism for us to attain enlightenment at the moment of death and afterwards. But that's a big subject. I'm not going to talk about this. I'm going to talk about this side, the journey to the afterlife, this side of death. So we're pushed back into the present. And recently, something that's been quite inspiring for me is that I've been reading the work of an American psychotherapist. He's very old now. He's called Irvin Yalom. I don't know if anybody's heard of him. He's an existential psychotherapist. You know him, right? He's written a lot about death. And Irvin Yalom is his name. He's an existential therapist. You know, he's not an afterlife guy. He believes this is it. And the book is really, really worth checking out. It's called Staring at the Sun. It's really meditations on death and his experience of talking to his clients, people who see him, about their anxieties about death. Now, he said something which really hooked me in, because I'm an anxious guy. I've got a sort of force field of anxiety, which will find it's like it'll find it's something to get anxious about. I get anxious about my career, my partner, my family, my kids, my money, my spiritual life,
hairstyle,
everything. I'll find something to be anxious about. But Irvin Yalom said something which really caught me, which was he said, anxiety about nothing, which is really what I'm talking about, a generalised anxiety, is anxiety about death. Mm-hmm. It's seeping through the cracks. You haven't got any choice, really, actually. Society can encourage us to not think about it, to ignore it, to consume our way out of it, or over it, or something. But sooner or later, it seeps its way in. Even if you don't actually experience death of people around you. You know, my dad died 10 years ago. And at the time, it was a strange thing. I didn't feel like I experienced much grief. We got on well, spent time with him before he died. He was a good guy. He was ill, you know, he'd been ill for quite a long time, so it wasn't a tragic death, but what happened afterwards, even though I felt like I hadn't experienced much grief, is that I started to do quite a lot of work about death, music about death, these events and stuff that we do, and actually most recently, of course, you know, I've been Death Cafe and various other things. It's seeping through. You know, it's my own mortality is becoming apparent to me. It's like a distant ship smoke on the horizon. It's probably my age, you know. I've got kids, two kids. You know, so they're sort of growing up. And, you know, all this stuff is coming through anyway. So, for me, doing the Death Cafe is—I go to Death Cafe because I really enjoy it. I really appreciate it. You know, it's what Irvin Yalom called staring at the sun. And what he was saying was that if you stare at the sun, if you do things which accept the fact of your own death, and you're in fear of them, what happens is, just as the Buddha said, life becomes sweeter, life becomes more meaningful. Now, it doesn't mean you get less anxious. In fact, I think when you start thinking about your own death, you get more anxious for a while anyway. It's a bit like going to the gym, you know, if you're out of shape. It's really painful at first, you know. But it does start to sort of tone you up. It does start to introduce this thing into your life. You know, you start to feel, we've talked about it time and time again, maybe become a bit kinder. You maybe start to choose how you're spending or wasting your time a bit more carefully. You know, the meditation earlier was saying, you know, what would you give up if you only had a year left? What would you stop doing? Or what would you start doing? These sort of questions I find, you know, as a result of doing this stuff, as a result of doing Death Cafe, they're coming in. Now, is it time for another Woody Allen quote, I think so. I'll backpedal a bit. He did say, actually, Woody Allen, I don't believe in the afterlife, although I'm bringing a change of underwear. Which reminded me of my mum, because actually she used to say, have you got some clean underwear on? Because you never know, you might get knocked over by a car, you know. So that was her worry, that I'd be knocked over and found with yesterday's underwear on. Bless her. So, right, well, so Jürgen Jalm recommended many things, but two of the things which struck me, which he recommended, if you're experiencing fear, you know, your fear of death, he said, and you don't believe in an afterlife or a god, he said, it's a technique or a reflection that he calls rippling, which is this: our lives do not end with our death. Neither did this start with our birth. For most of us, I hope anyway, we were anticipated before we were born. Maybe planned. Like I said, I'm a Catholic, so I wasn't planned. It was just Vatican roulette, as we call them. But, you know, certainly when I was news of my impending arrival had come, you know, things were planned. You know, my name, I'm not sure if I had a name beforehand, but often parents give their children to be born names, buy clothes for them, prepare a room, prepare a cot. They're anticipated, they discuss with doctors, they discuss with relatives. So we don't begin with our birth. We are already there, and neither do we end with our death. Even if there isn't an afterlife, our life has consequences. We are remembered, for a while at least, by our loved ones. And I was thinking, I think about my teachers sometimes. I was taught, and a couple of teachers when I was at school had a big effect on me, positive effect. They're dead now. But, you know, their lives are rippling on in me. They've changed me somewhat. And it's, you know, I am changing things in the world. So it's a useful reflection, isn't it, that our lives don't end with our death, that we keep going. There's something comforting about that, I find, imaginatively so. Now, the other thing he said was, one of the things Irving Allen said was, go global, effectively, that what he was saying, was that we're all going to die, for sure. We're all going to face it alone. We're going to walk through that door on our own. Nobody can come with us. But we all do it, every single one of us. And reflecting on that, there is a sort of sense of community, which I find, again, somewhat comforting. Now, there's a famous Buddhist parable. I forget the name of the woman. What is the name of the woman I'm going to mention? Ranthaprabha?
Kiss the Goat's
Meat. Kiss the Goat's Meat. So, I'm sure. Does some people know the story about Kiss the Goat's Meat? Does everybody know it? Right. Well, so the Buddha, with his followers, I think he arrives at a village, and news of his coming has already spread. And when he arrives there, a woman, Kiss the Goat's Meat, rushes to him. She's got a dead baby. Her baby's died. She's absolutely distraught with grief. And of course, you know, you can imagine in India that an enlightened being is coming, the news is spread. So she's got all sorts of things that she thinks about the Buddha. And she rushes up to him and, you know, begs him, says, please, 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 you've got the power. I know you've got the power. You can bring my baby back to life. Now, the Buddha didn't have the power, well, not in the Theravada times anyway, to bring a baby back to life. But he didn't say, okay, no, I can't do it. He was, I suppose you'd say, it was a trick, it was skillful means. He said, well, I guess he said in a way, I may be able to help, but I can only help if you can do something in return. She said, I'll do anything. He said, well, go to a house, if you can find a house in the village where there hasn't been a death, a bereavement, and they'll give you a mustard seed. Mm. You can bring the mustard seed back, let's see what you can do. So she rushes off. First house she goes to, bangs on the door. They open the door, you know, she's totally distraught. She says, please, please, you know, you've got to give me, if you get a mustard seed, if I can find a house where there wasn't a death, you know, you can give me a mustard seed, I can go back to the Buddha, he's going to bring my baby back to life. And they say, well, God, you know, we'd love to help, actually, but we can't, you know. My mother died just a couple of weeks ago. We're grieving. So she rushes off to the next house, bangs on the door, they open up the door and says, please, you know, if there's not something of death in you, give me mustard seed, I can go back and my baby will come back to life. And they said, really sorry, we'd love to help, but we have a child too who dies. Well, you can imagine the rest of the story. She goes around every house in the village. There isn't one house in the village where there hasn't been a death, where they're not grieving or haven't grieved. And of course, it didn't stop her grieving the loss of her baby. She still would feel that. But what's it done? It's put it into a big context. Mm-hmm. That her grief, her loss, her bereavement, this tragedy, this personal tragedy, which is gigantic in her imagination, suddenly it's still there, but her view of it is much wider. She's seeing that gigantic thing in a context of other people, of community. So that reflection, you know, as Irving said, you know, going global, to reflect that this stuff, you know, it happens to everybody. And actually that's, you know, another thing about Death Cafe, because you come and you just talk about it with other people. Strangers, it's amazing. Come into a room with strangers, you've been, haven't you? 5 minutes after you're in there, what's that? People talking about the most intimate things, right? And I've never seen people leave Death Cafe more unhappy than when they arrived. In fact, people tend to leave looking really rather cheerful, which is odd, right? It's called Death Cafe, you think it'd be really morbid and depressing. But usually people leave with a bit of a skip in their step, right?
Is it the sugar?
Sugar helps, for sure. So, I'm going to finish up. So, I promised you a list, didn't I? I love lists. Actually, let's have a bit of Woody. I've got a bit of Woody Allen before I finish up. It says, my relationship with death remains the same. I'm strongly against it. But I said I would help you overcome your fear of death, and I've got 10 ways to do that here. You don't have to remember them all, just pick out one that you like. Okay, first one, it sounds like a no-brainer, but make a will. Who's made a will? It's about average for London. So 70% of adults in London have not made a will. So, why? Why bother making a will? I ask most of my friends haven't made a will. You ask them, say, I have nothing to leave, apart from debt. Well, actually, it's usually not true, but actually, make a will for the sake of people you leave behind. Right? Make it easy for them. My mum is an exemplar in this respect. She's actually paid for her funeral. She's planned it down to the last detail. She's cleared the house of, like, virtually everything. It's almost like her bag's at the door. She's just worried that she's going to get a taxi to the afterlife. So, but make a will, it helps, it actually reduces your anxiety about your own life, it clarifies things, okay? And if not for you, do it for other people, okay? Make a living will, if you're bothered about this stuff. A living will is what you would like or not like to happen to you in certain circumstances, depending on your health, if you physically fail. And if this matters to you, you can make a living will. For sure, we live in a country where you can't tell the doctors to finish you off if you're past a certain point, but there are things that can be done, interventions which you don't have to have, you don't have to be resuscitated. If that matters to you, do it. But the third of this sort of trio, which I think is a big one for all of us, and a bit easier in some ways than a living will, is, have you considered your digital legacy? Now, this is really important for younger people, particularly, because they live their whole lives online. Now, a friend of mine, James Norris, runs something called Dead Social, and he's designed a whole lot of tools, actually, in this area. He's big on this stuff. If you're signed up to Facebook, how many people signed up to Facebook? Right. Twitter, anybody? Right. Is your current tweet something that you would be proud to leave behind you? Or your current Facebook post, particularly if it shows you in a compromising position on Saturday night somewhere. It's a bit of a joke, isn't it? But actually it's quite important, because as we live more and more of our lives online, what's going to happen to that if you die? Has somebody got access to it? Do you want it to carry on? Some people want their Facebook, their profiles to be there when they're dead. James, my friend, has set up tools that you can even your Facebook account can keep posting when you're dead. A bit creepy, I think, personally, but that's what some people want. But, you know, maybe you don't want to do that, but maybe you would like to finish with a positive message. Think about it, okay? It's important stuff for all of us. If we get knocked down tomorrow, what's going to happen to our digital legacy, right? Okay. Become a donor. Now, last year at London Month of the Dead, we had Professor William Ayliffe, who's a transplant surgeon. He came and gave an amazing talk on the history of transplantation. He worked mainly with eyes. It's a bit weird. He actually transplanted his mother's cornea into a blind person. Amazing guy. But he gave an impassioned plea for people to become organ donors, to sign up for that. It's really important. It's our last chance to be generous. You can also leave your body to medical science, which is also useful. And if you're not sure what you want to happen after you die to your body, it's quite a good option, actually. If you leave your body to medical science in London hospitals, they'll pay for your funeral. And actually, there's a very moving service in Southwark Cathedral once a year where all the students, the medical students, come to Southwark Cathedral, and there is a service for the families of people who've donated their bodies to medical science. It's really moving, actually. And so it's worth thinking about, actually. What else are you going to do with it? But maybe you have got something else you want to do with it, and I'll say this, plan your funeral, right? There are a lot more options now than just being buried or burned. You can have a green funeral. People I know down in Totnes has run something called the Green Funeral Company. They're amazing things. Pagan things, humanist things, Buddhist things. They're Buddhist, actually. What you're told is supposed to happen to your body or your loved one's body is not the case, actually. There's a lot more beautiful things that can happen, actually. Look into it. People often say, well, I'm not going to be here, I don't care. And I'll say, well, do you mind if we play Phil Collins' I'm Still Standing at your funeral? Most people will say, yes, I do mind. Well, okay, plan your funeral then, because you never know what's going to happen, do you, right? Now, here's one I got from Oprah. It doesn't sound an obvious thing about dying and death, but it's keep a gratitude diary. I got this from Oprah Winfrey. Oprah Winfrey, when asked, said that the thing she felt most significantly contributed to her well-being was that every day she keeps a gratitude diary. She writes down four or five things which she's grateful for. Now, I do this. I've been doing it for quite a long time, and I've got to say, it works. In context of our life and our death, it brings home to you the stuff that matters from your life, the stuff that you value. Now, I pinched this one from Colin, actually, for a little bit, and I hope he doesn't mind me putting it on this. Keep a bullet list. Forgive me if I get this wrong, but this is what I think you understand. I mean, what a list of things that you would like to do, or meaningful things that you would like to do in your life. We did it a little bit in the meditation earlier. You know, what am I not doing that I would like to do? If I knew I was going to die in a year, what would I do? You know, what are the things that I would do? Think about that stuff. And then you go through it. Go through it now. Make sure you've done them now. Is that right, Colin? Am I sort of... Bucket list, yeah, that's what it was. You reviewed it at the beginning of every month, right?
Yeah.
Brilliant. Love that. I love that. So I've got here... I'm using horrible pop culture references here, but... phone a friend. So what does that mean? Well, let me tell you a little story. A friend of mine who's a Russian music journalist, Artemy Troitsky, I was with him a few months back in London, and he told me that I'm interested in a Russian musician in Soviet times who died quite young. It's a tragic story. Now, Artemy knew him. They grew up together. They were born on the same day. They were very good friends. They went through that whole thing of the Soviet Union perestroika and glasnost, it all breaking down. And Sergei Kuryokin was this incredibly talented musician, beautiful looking guy, funny, you know, everything going from, you know, best mates. And they fell out over politics. Kuryokin joined a right wing party in the Soviet Union, and Artemy couldn't stand that. Did a huge row, public row actually, and they fell out. And Kuryokin was taken ill and was diagnosed with heart cancer. The age of 40, and a month later he was dead. And I was with Art in a cafe in Notting Hill, and this is 25, 30 years ago. He still hasn't got over it. because they fell out a month before this guy died. He never got a chance to make it up. So I put phone a friend in. So if we've got some conflict from the past with family member, friend, sort it out. Because you never know, even if you don't die, they might die, right? Okay, so we're getting towards the end. Number 9, meditate. Vlasa Mani sent me a text yesterday saying, death is enforced meditation. Still working on that one. But, the Tibetans say this, it's the nearest you're going to get to consciousness before death is meditation. Get used to it. Get used to experiencing just your own consciousness, separate from all the other stuff in the eternal present. Meditation is a preparation for death. It's said in the teachings of Buddhism, that one thing that is going to be useful to you at death is Dharma. So we're already doing it. That's great, right? So my number 10 is, guess what? Come to Death Cafe. Easy, right? First Saturday of every month here. I'm not going to be here the next one, but you are welcome to come always. It's really good. So I think I'm nearly there. I'm just going to finish with two things. I'll finish with a bit of Woody Allen. There are worse things in life than death. Have you ever spent an evening with an insurance salesman? Sorry, is there no insurance salesman here, are there? Okay, so we're going to finish. So what I'd say is, let's just close our eyes again. Okay? And go back to that scene of horror, sitting in that cremation ground, the charnel ground. We've been sitting there all night, meditating next to a corpse. And it's been a terrifying night. Animals have come, birds of prey, dogs. There's been awful smells. We've been scared of ghosts and spirits. All our childhood fears have come. But we managed to sit there, breathing in, breathing out. And now, the sun's coming up. So, we blow out the candle. We stand up. We pack our things in our little bag. And we bow to the corpse that we were meditating next to, remembering that this once was a beautiful person with emotions and memories and friends and parents. And we leave the charnel ground and we walk back down the path through the trees, through the forest, down, down. The trees finish, we come into the fields, the path winds through the fields. We walk along it and we see there are people coming out of the village, starting their day. And they bow to us as we walk past. The fields end and we come back into the village. And we walk down the street. And at the end is the building where we started off. And we enter the building. We go and take our place again in front of our teacher. And our teacher looks at us and smiles and says, "So, what are you going to do with the rest of your life?" Thanks for listening, everybody. That's it. We're done. There is one more thing. And I was actually, when we were meditating earlier, I was going to play the song at the end. I think it's always good to finish on a song, musician and all that. And I chickened out, actually, because you'll see why, I think, when I play the song. But I was slightly worried that Rana Prabha might have thought that I'd become a born-again Christian. And as you don't know me very well, most of you, I didn't want to freak anybody out, but I thought it would be quite nice to finish with a song. I'm sort of thinking about having this played at my funeral, actually. So if you can, I'll play a bit of it. You can close your eyes. You can ignore the words, for sure. It's just the emotion of it, right? The abode.
Lord, it's been the word.